This is Biasbender, and I'm Kayla Stokes. Welcome to the next episode of this podcast, where we are exploring the lives of Black women from the past and the present in order to imagine the future. This week, we are talking about Hattie McDaniel and playing the role. Hi, everyone. How are you doing? Things are just as humid and hot as they were last week for me, but I'm doing pretty well. So last week I talked about storytelling and what I think about my role in retelling history. Thanks again for listening and sharing your thoughts with me on that subject. I really appreciate it. I think I'll always be considering what it means to tell stories, big and small, so I feel really grateful for the space to do so on this podcast. I believe this week's episode ties into the conversation I started last week. We'll be talking about a woman whose life and legacy is intrinsically tied into the complicated idea and practice of storytelling. Hattie McDaniel is a name that I've seen a lot over the years, so her most notable accomplishment isn't new to me. I imagine you might know her name and what she's most known for as well. She is one of the people that I see all the time on those listicles that have titles like 10 Black Women You Should Know About or 5 Black Hollywood Actors Who Paved the Way. She's usually number one or two on those lists, to be honest, but I want to take the time this week to go over her story and think beyond the time she made history in the spotlight. I know there's so much more to her than the night she won a Sparkly Award, and I want to get into that side of the story. Also, June 10th happens to be her birthday, so now feels like a good time to reflect on her life. All right, let's just jump right into it. As I just said, Hattie McDaniel was born on June 10th, 1893. Her beginnings were beyond humble. She was born into extreme poverty in Wichita, Kansas. She was the last of 13 children to be born to her parents, Henry and Susan. Both of her parents were formerly enslaved, and her father was a Civil War veteran, and her mother was a maid. Just knowing that Hattie was so close to the realities of slavery and the Civil War makes the trajectory of her career all the more complicated, but we'll get there. Something that I learned about her growing up that rocked me to the core was that she often had to help her father fill out endless paperwork so that he could try and collect the pension that he was owed from his time in the service. It turns out that he was denied an increase in his pension because he couldn't officially prove his age. And when he received notification of this, he wrote back saying, "It is impossible for me to furnish a record of my birth. I was a slave." That just made me feel a whole lot of things when I read that. But yeah, Hattie grew up in an environment that was directly impacted by the effects of slavery. I mean, to be honest, if you grew up in the United States of America at any point, even now, you are being affected by the legacy of slavery, but you know what I mean. She really saw up close and personal the contradictory nature of our country. And of course, that impact wasn't only placed on her father. It ran deep through her whole family. She watched as her mother and her sisters toiled away as maids in white homes. At the same time, she was a child who had a lot of spirit within her. While she was brought into the world in Kansas, her family moved to Denver, Colorado, where she was raised for the most part. It sounds like she was always singing and performing around her family in church and in school with her friends. Hattie left school early to keep performing. Some of her siblings were also in the game at the time, so she had a built-in crew of fellow performers who taught her the ropes. Hattie and her siblings became popular with the Black communities in Denver for their plays and revues. She created an all-female minstrel show with her sister, Etta. They were billed as the McDaniel Sisters Company, and they put on shows that basically mocked the white minstrel shows of the day. They put on whiteface and also performed as caricatures of what white performers thought Black people were like. It was very tongue-in-cheek, and it sounds like the Black people who attended their performances liked laughing at the satirical jokes they made. It was a space for Black people to make fun of the stereotypes they were being labeled with all the time. I get it. Sometimes you just have to laugh at even the most sinister parts of our society. It helps you get through it. So, after finding success in her hometown of Denver, Hattie went on the road. She performed all over the place in various vaudeville acts and as a blues singer. A lot of her work was self-generated, and in the early years of her life on the road, she had to keep it going all by herself. She wasn't guaranteed anything, so when gigs weren't coming in, she had to supplement her creative work with domestic work to make ends meet. But in 1929, she landed a regular gig. Hattie performed in the tour of the hit musical Showboat. Unfortunately, if you know anything about that year in our history, you'd know that entertainment, along with most industries, was about to take a big hit. When the stock market crashed, Hattie's secure gig wasn't so secure anymore. In fact, she was laid off and abandoned on one of the tour's stops. She found herself in Milwaukee in need of a job. So she got a job as a bathroom attendant at Sam Pick's Suburban Inn, which was a nightclub in the city of Milwaukee. The story goes that one night a performer never showed up, so Hattie stepped in and sang on stage, and of course, everyone loved her, and she secured a headlining gig with the club on the spot. She stayed for about 2 years until Sam Pick's had to close as well due to the Great Depression. And this marked a big shift in Hattie's career because she had to figure out what she was going to do. She decided to pack up her things and the little money she had and head out to Hollywood. Now, once she got to Hollywood, she was able to pick up a lot of roles. But at the time, there weren't many roles for people who looked like her beyond maids and mammy characters. The movies that were being written by white men called for garish stereotypes, and honestly, it makes me cringe to even think about what those casting calls were like. But Hattie decided that she wanted to be in show business, and she would rather be a part of this twisted industry and make money performing than not. In her words, she said, "I can be a maid for $7 a week, or I can play a maid for $700 a week." By the mid-30s, Hattie was kind of the go-to comedic Black actress in Hollywood. She was 1,000% typecast as a jolly, sassy maid, but she was consistently working. You know, I'm finding this a little uncomfortable to talk about, because I feel myself judging her work when I have no idea what it was actually like. I can read all of these articles about her career, but I'll never really know what she was thinking as she was going into auditions or shaping her career with her management. It must be so much more complicated than her saying one day, "Oh yeah, I'm cool with playing these stereotypes," because while she was asked to portray not so varied roles, she was also showing up. And she was creating a name for herself, and she was getting a face and body like hers on the big screen, which, in my book, is a victory. So, I don't know. As I'm learning and telling her story, I need to just keep taking a step back and appreciate how difficult it was to be a Black woman in the industry at all in the freaking 30s. Okay. Having said that, there were a lot of people who were critical of her work at the time, and a lot of the criticism came after she was offered her most famous role. Now, in 1937, there was this whole moment around the casting of David O. Zelsnick's upcoming movie version of Gone with the Wind. there was a nationwide search for the role that, as you might know, eventually went to Hattie McDaniel. The role was named Mammy and was a jovial, enslaved character. Apparently, during the search for the right actress, Bing Crosby suggested Hattie to David based off of her performance in the movie version of Showboat. And when word got out that Hattie would appear in the movie as an enslaved person, the NAACP had plenty to say about it. They weren't pleased that a famous actress like Hattie would take this big role and be willing to portray a subservient enslaved person. And furthermore, if you know Gone with the Wind, you'd know that it's riddled with racism. So a lot of prominent Black folks at this time weren't happy. However, Hattie went through with it, and it sounds like the Black performers on set banded together in support of one another. I know from my own experiences in tough creative spaces that when you have even one friend in the room, it makes a big difference. So I was glad to hear that the Black cast members were able to kind of lean on one another, because regardless of if you said yes to this type of role, it must have been weird. So after the movie was shot and everything was said and done, you'd think that Hattie would have had it made in the shade. Well, you'd be wrong. She was not just not invited to the premiere, she was purposefully sent a message of do not come to the premiere, because of course it was held in a segregated venue. Oh, but the author sent her a telegram saying, wish she could have heard the applause. Don't get me started on how ridiculous that is. And then to top it off, she won an Oscar for her role in Gone with the Wind. You might already know that because it's what she's famous for today. She was the first Black person ever to win an Oscar. The daughter of two formerly enslaved people was awarded the award for portraying an enslaved woman. I know that the role wasn't the most forward or radical thing in the world, but I think the idea in itself is still a big deal. She accepted the award from a segregated hotel where the Oscars were taking place. She wasn't seated with the rest of her white cast, but off to the side at her own little table. But she walked up when her name was called and accepted the historic award nonetheless. And, of course, this furthered a rift she had with the leader of the NAACP, Walter White. Walter believed that he knew what was best for the forward movement of Hollywood, and in his opinion, work like Hattie's had no place in the future. And I understand his frustration with the portrayal of characters that Hattie was playing. But at the same time, I get why Hattie wasn't his biggest fan. He was incredibly critical of her specifically. He announced that he was going to meet with Hollywood executives to determine what would be okay for Black performers in the industry as they moved forward, instead of including Black actors in that conversation. He also touted Lena Horne as the future of Black Hollywood. Now, he wasn't wrong. Lena Horne did go on to have quite the career, and I'm sure I'll have a whole episode about her one day, but in saying that a light-skinned, dainty woman was the only way to move the Black image in Hollywood forward, he was excluding women who were bigger and dark-skinned, like Hattie, from the conversation of the future of Hollywood. So I get where he was coming from, but his approach wasn't perfect either. And in some ways, his views kind of became the norm. Hattie didn't see the success she thought she would after winning an Oscar. She continued to have to play these stereotypical maid roles because the industry couldn't imagine her playing anything else. It feels like they left her behind. She performed in more movies, but eventually she found herself working in radio. In her final year, she took over the titular role of Beulah, which was originally played by a white man named Bob Corley. I mean, I guess that's an improvement. The character was much like most of the characters she played in her career, a funny live-in maid who made people laugh with her wit. She was even cast in the TV version of the show, but she only shot 6 episodes of it before falling quite sick. At the age of 57, Hattie passed away on October 26, 1952, of breast cancer. And that's not really where her story ends. She made her final wishes very known, but they weren't all met. Hattie wanted to be buried in what was then known as the Hollywood Cemetery. Many famous Hollywood folks were buried there. However, because she was Black, Hattie was turned away yet again, even after she died. Instead, she was buried in Angulus Rosedale Cemetery, which was the first cemetery open to all races in LA. Hattie also specified that she wanted her Oscar to be left to Howard University. The award did make its way there, however, it has been missing since the 70s. I say all of this to say that I feel like Hattie's legacy has been mistreated. Sure, I wouldn't call her a radical activist, but she tried. She lived through so many moments where her dignity was stripped away. Also, we can say, oh, she was the first Black person to win an Oscar. And meanwhile, we don't know where that Oscar is. I don't know. I feel like that's a disservice to a woman who worked hard and wanted to be in the industry that she had a passion for. Hattie's life and career is pretty well documented because of her eventual fame. And I'm glad that I know her story, but I'm also thinking about all the other performers whose stories aren't as well known. I wonder what it must have been like for the performers who never caught a break. I realize from Hattie's story that reaching a huge milestone in your career can't protect you from mistreatment or discrimination, so I can only imagine that in the case of folks who weren't given time in the spotlight, it must have been even harder in some ways. Like, what the heck was it like for the extras in the movies? If you happen to know anyone who did that kind of work, please let me know, because I'd love to deepen my understanding of the history of the entertainment industry even more. Anyway, I'm really glad that I got to know more about Hattie McDaniel and learn what her life was like a bit beyond the headlines.
Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Science, fellow members of the motion picture industry and honored guests, this is one of the happiest moments of my life. And I want to thank each one of you who had a part in selecting me for one of the awards. For your kindness, it has made me feel very, very humble. And I shall always hold it as a beacon for anything that I may be able to do in the future. I sincerely hope I shall always be a credit to my race and to the motion picture industry. My heart is too full to tell you just how I feel. And may I say thank you. God bless you.
And that's the story of Hattie McDaniel. It's so complicated to hear about how her life reflects the roles she ended up taking. I don't know, I just keep coming back to the word complicated. I think Hattie did the best she knew how to do. She wanted to be a successful performer, and during the time she was working, I think she did what she had to do to get to that point. I happen to be pretty far removed from the time she lived in, so I'm able to look at her story and say, you know, I don't blame her. I get where she was coming from. And at the same time, I understand why folks were disappointed with seeing her portray the types of characters many Black people did not want to be associated with. I get that too. And on top of that, I wonder to myself, would I know who Hattie was? And would she have become a household name if she didn't play roles that white people asked her to? And would I have been able to have this layered look at her life and the idea of storytelling if her career were less known? I don't know the answer to those questions, or if those are the right questions to be asking, but that's what's on my mind after learning about Hattie. If I turn my thoughts to the future, I'm left thinking about what it means to give space to Black artists so that they can explore whatever they want to. I think I feel a pressure to get it right. And that might be an internal pressure mostly, but I also recognize that there is a lot of criticism thrown towards art and entertainment created by Black people. As a person who creates things, and as a person who creates things with the hope that those things will be consumed by others, I feel like we are still living in a space where it's tough to put something out in the world that is messy, for lack of a better term. And to be honest, I fall into that trap of wanting the work that I see and consume to be satisfying and excellent all the time. But I want to live in a world where Black people make and see art and performance that is messy and risky. Sure, I want to watch TV shows that are sappy and make me feel good, but I look forward to a future where we have the space for all types of work. Work that is exploring difficult things in not so neat ways. Work that challenges what we know to be true. Work that upsets us. Work that we don't like. And I want to exist in a future where we don't dismiss this type of work as a failure or not worth discussing and unpacking. That's my hope for the future. It might sound weird, but I want a future for Black artists where we can make something not good and still be successful. Anyway, I'm really glad I learned about Hattie this week because she's reignited my thoughts about all of this. And her story is definitely worth reflecting on. All right, that's all I have for you this week. I'll catch you next time, and until then, thank you so much for listening. I used the following sources to research this week's episode. Vanity Fair's article, The Icon and the Outcast, Hattie McDaniel's Epic Double Life by Hadley Hall Mirrors. The Hollywood Reporter's article, Oscar's First Black Winner Accepted Her Honor in a Segregated No Blacks Hotel in L.A. by Seth Abramovich. The Encyclopedia Britannica's article on Hattie McDaniel. Biography.com's article on Hattie McDaniel. Elle Magazine's article, Hollywood, Who Was Hattie McDaniel, the First Black Oscar Winner Played by Queen Latifah, by Adrian Gaffney. Original music, as always, by Adam Westerman. This podcast is supported in part by a 4 Culture ARC Artist Fellowship.